Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And today our guest is Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. Bill is the moving force behind Amateur Radio Newsline. He's going to be talking all about that, talking about his beginnings in ham radio, as well as about the Young Ham of the Year Award that Bill came up with. We'll be back with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, right after this on QSO. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. With us is Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. And if you say Amateur Radio Newsline, well, you're talking right up his alley. And how is Bill today?
Well, it's 10 o'clock at night in the City of Angels, Los Angeles, and I'm fine, actually, because 3 months ago at this hour, I'd be sitting in the control room doing a newscast. Now I'm home, and I am retired.
Let me ask you a question. Did you just switch over to a speakerphone or something?
No.
No? Okay, then all of a sudden, I heard this big, long room echo, so maybe you just backed away from the phone here for a little bit.
That's weird.
My question for you right now is Amateur Radio Newsline. I'd like to know, what was the inspiration to start this incredible news program? And how did you originally get it off the ground, and how did it develop into what it is right now?
Well, actually, I did not. I'm not the originator of it. I am one of the co-founders of it. But the originator of what is now Amateur Radio Newsline was Jim Hendershot, WA6ZQP, a friend of mine, who back in 1976, with repeater deregulation, if you remember back then, all of a sudden, 1976, early 77, the word came down that we're going to deregulate repeaters. Repeaters are going to become, no more restrictions that had been imposed by the Prose Walker, who was the chief of the Amateur and Citizen Division back at the FCC. It'll all be an overridden, and how do you get the news out? My friend Jim Hendershot said, well, let's do a newscast, and he'll get somebody to take it up on a hilltop with a portable radio and broadcast on 223.5 megahertz in the 220 band, which was a big band back in Los Angeles, nowhere else in the country. A lot of activity on 223.5 simplex, and that's what happened. We put together a half-hour newscast and brought in a bunch of local hams, and it was, who was it? trying to remember the guy who took it up on a motorcycle with a Midland 13509 on top of Contractor's Point and played the thing off of a Norelco carry quarter. We're dating ourselves, aren't we, with that stuff? And that was it. That was going to be the end of it. Jim did it, told everybody repeater deregulation had happened, and that was it. And the following week, there was no newscast. It was called, he called it the Westlink Amateur Radio News, because Jim Hendershot owned the Western Linking System, or Westlink. So, Westlink News.
So that was the beginning of the Newsline program.
Yeah, well, it was Westlink Amateur Radio News at the time. But yeah, that and it actually stayed as the Westlink Amateur Radio News for, gee whiz, we started in 77, and it was into, I think it was 89 when we renamed it. And, 89 or 90, something like that. And the name change came about only because a friend of mine, Bert Hicks, had started a news a newsletter, and the names were the same. And it was just too Westlink Report, and people were getting too mixed up. So we just the name, the Amateur Radio Newsline name, came from there used to be on Radio Netherlands a program called Newsline, and it was the news of the world from Radio Netherlands. And a friend of mine produced it over there, and I said, hey, you mind if I use that name for my ham radio thing? He said, no, go ahead. And that's how that's where it came from. It's just Newsline was borrowed.
Well, now, you know, you have a lot of content on here. You have a lot of voices on Newsline, you know, and I guess from the standpoint of a person listening to this, just the regular average ham like myself, you know, you're listening to this thing, and you don't really realize how much production and how much writing and how much stuff really goes into this thing every week. I mean, now, being in the radio business, I know that, but I think the average person doesn't realize it. Tell us a little bit how it goes together and how you're able to pull it all off, and when you actually are finished with the broadcast.
Well, let's pick it up where we were earlier. My friend Jim Hendershot and I have been working on this. And our original source, going back now, we're talking late 1970, 77 through like mid-78, mostly came from something which you've never heard of called the ARL Director's Letter, which was the ARL director in each division would send out a letter, literally a letter to people in the division saying, you know, ARL members, and saying, this is what we're doing. And a lot of the information came from there. There was also Ham Radio Magazine had something called HR Report. And we'd steal stuff from there. And a lot of it also came from, again, this was originally a local Los Angeles and then Southern California thing. A lot of it just came from what was happening on the air here in California. So the original programs were ARL Director's Letter, HR Report, and Ham Happenings, literally from Southern California. That's where it started. And what the weird thing was that people heard about it and they wanted to hear it. So Jim would make cassettes. I think it was a Panasonic RQ309. It was a $39 cassette recorder with a pad on the input from put line level into a mic input off of an old Ampex that he was doing the show on. And I was basically doing mostly writing in that time. And he would send out cassettes, and I'd help him sometimes. I set up a duplicating system here at the house. I had a Norelco carry quarter because I had a bunch of those around. And the Revere T700. And he'd make me a duplicate tape, and I'd make cassettes. He'd make a set, and we'd mail them out. And this is, you know, and all of a sudden it started to grow. I mean, it got big.
Now, Revere is pre-Wallensack.
Well, Revere Camera Company bought out Wallensack Camera Company. That's because I did a lot of repairs on projectors and audio recorders and stuff. And the Revere Camera Company absorbed Wallensack. It was, that was the year, 1959, 1960. I'm giving my age away, but I'm 68. I turned 68 the other day. But I worked on sound projectors, silent projectors, cameras, and stuff like that back in my misspent youth. As a matter of fact, we'll get into it, how I got started, but there's a place that used to exist in Brooklyn, New York, where I found it, called Rose Radio, and I'll talk about that later. Anyway, so we make copies and mail them out, and all of a sudden it's getting up to like 50 copies, 60 copies, and it's all over. People from Florida, people from the Mid, a lot of people from the Midwest, Ohio, Illinois, and these people wanted to hear this newscast, this ham radio newscast that was coming out of Los Angeles that was all about Los Angeles, which is kind of weird, isn't it? You know, when you think about it. Why did these people want to hear? Because there was no other product. There was nothing else. You had that, or you could maybe, if you were lucky, hear the ARL's 20-meter bulletin, voice bulletin, record it and play it back with all the static and noise. I've been always one of these people who believe that voice bulletins have no place on the HF bands. They serve no purpose. It's my own opinion. If you want to listen to something, you want to listen to it comfortably, and there's nothing better if you want to listen to it than an FM receiver. You know that, and I know that from working in the business. And so anyway, Jim and Mandershot and myself geared this to FM, to FM repeaters, narrowband FM. And Jim being a broadcast guy, me being a broadcast guy, we just used our knowledge from the industry of how to make good audio, and it's always sounded good, I think, and it was done with originally with cast-off equipment. People didn't want, and we would use the equipment to, let's see, what did I have? My original equipment here at the house was, as I said, a Revere recorder to record and playback on, and I had a Sony TC200, which I converted into an editing system using an Editable block and splicing tape, if you remember those days. Splicing tape.
Razor blades and blocks.
Gem single-edge razor blades, yep. I date back to winding my own carts. So, and by the way, that's how we do it. What happened was when Jim Hendershot decided he was getting married, and he was leaving Los Angeles area. Actually moved initially up to San Luis Obispo, and he had no time for this anymore. And he asked me if I wanted to take it over. And I said, if I can find some help, yes. Okay. And so to make this legal, by the way, I purchased it from him for $20, and then we proceeded to use that $20 to go out and have ice cream. So, at a Howard Johnson's. So he actually sold me for $20 the rights to what was then the Westlink Amateur Radio News and Network. So, and that's how it started. And then what happened was, I have a very good friend. Still have a good friend. He's retired now. Lives in Hawaii. Named Bill Ornstein. His call at the time was KH6IAF. It's now KH6QX. Bill worked for NBC as an audio guy. He was A2 on the Tonight Show. A2 means he's the guy basically who ran the public address system in the station, in the studio, way up in the loft at the top of what's this? I forget which day studio it was. I've been there so many times. Anyway, he would do the PA. And he was a very competent audio editor, And so we got together and decided, well, we're going to do it, but we're going to do it a little differently. A, we're going to do a little higher broadcast standard. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to stop this mail out. This 100, 150 tapes a week was getting expensive. So Jay O'Brien, W6GO, lived up, and I don't know if Jay's still around, but lived up in the San Francisco Bay area, had a pair of automatic electric cart machines. They were Mark Collins, but they were really automatic electric. And he offered them to us and had some old broadcast carts, he sent them down to me, and I said, yeah, I'm going to make one of these things into the world's only cart machine telephone answering device. And that's what I did. I converted it into a TAD. So that what would happen would be, you'd have these, if you remember, you're familiar, of course, with the Fidelipak tapes, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So we bought some of the Type A's, 15-minute ones, which were the largest you could get. That's what we were at, 15 minutes in those days, because we were constrained by the size of the tape. And we put together this newscast. And trying to remember who was the first guy. I forgot the guy's name. Anyway, the first guy, we did one, and it was very well received. And then all of a sudden, it started to take off. It started to just, wow, it is. And so we put this machine in, and Bill had an office in Hollywood, 7058 Hollywood Boulevard. and we got a phone line, dedicated phone line, put it in there, and the way it would work was very interesting. The phone would ring. We'd never hear it ring. We'd hear the capstan go clunk on this thing, and it would play the tape, and then the cue at the end of the tape would drop the machine out and hang up the phone line. It was just very rudimentary. It used, I think I was using tubes. I think I built that with tubes, as a matter of fact. So, and then it progressed into other machines. We got some, as a matter of fact, I still have my old broadcast electric sitting in the closet here, which hasn't been plugged in 10 years. And we stayed distribution-wise. I'm talking the distribution line right now. We stayed with tape and phone lines for...
You're listening to QSO. We'll be back with our guest, WA6ITF Bill Pasternak, right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, if you're listening by podcast. Tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now on QSO, back to our guest, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
And that was the way we did it until cassettes came along, actually cassette-based answering machines. And we found in exploring these things that they got better and better, especially with Panasonic. Panasonic came out with some very advanced stuff. And we're talking now late 80s. And we were able to get away from cartridges and go to cassettes, and cassettes gave us up to 45 minutes on the side using decent cassettes. And we basically decided we'd never go past 20, 25 minutes, 30 minutes at the most, and we've stayed with that. And that's been our format, time-wise, using cassettes and automated cassette machines. All we did was actually disconnect the remote electronics, and we had one time there were like 10 locations around the country, and we would airmail out cassettes to a day ahead of time so that everybody would be on target at the same time, or phone feed some of the people if they wanted it that way. But that gradually, what happened was the Internet came along, and the Internet and we got talked into a friend of ours, one of our Newsline reporters and has anchored for us, David Black, ABC4KCH, a friend of his, was playing around with a format called True Speech, which was the very, very first, I believe, streaming audio system.
It was. True Speech was the very first.
And we adopted it. And I figured, where's this going to go? It's not going to mean anything. All of a sudden, everybody's saying, wow, that's good. We like that. We didn't have a website, okay? David's friend had a website, and he would take we'd phone feed it to him, and he'd put it up on his website, and we found that the need for cassettes was disappearing real quick, that the number of people calling in was dropping off because people were using the True Speech. And that's about the time that Dale Carey came into our life, and Dale said, would you like a website? I've never been known to say no to anything. So a website came about, our very first website, and we've matriculated and gone from site to site to site and ISP to ISP, like everybody does, okay? We started very simple, got complex, and then simplified it to what we have now. We have probably one of the fastest loading and simplest websites in the world, and thanks to those fine folks at Allen Labs out here in Los Angeles. And we then went to Real Audio, and that lasted for a while. And then along came MP3, and the quality was just... And that's what we've been doing now for, 10, 12 years, running MP3 files. And we still maintain one phone line. Originally what happened was we had two phone lines we paid for in Los Angeles, and the other 8 or 9 around the country were radio clubs in different... And I'm trying to remember, Metroplex in New York, for example, had a line actually in New Jersey that... There were two guys who had lines up in the Pacific Northwest. There was one in Washington D.C. There was one in Brooklyn, New York, for a while, my old hometown. They would just spring up. They'd be there for a while, and then the people would get tired, and someone else would take over. There was always about eight. For about 10 years, there was 8, 9, 10 phone lines around the country, and they would change, but ours remained constant. We had two lines. We were paying for them, and newscasts would go up. Originally it was on Sundays, and then we got asked because of the nets and things, could we do it earlier? So we adopted Thursday night, Friday morning, actually, midnight for Thursday Pacific. And that's been how long now? Oh, God, since the late 80s. That's been our release schedule, except when somebody's out of town or so.
And well, how would you utilize the phone lines? Would those lines like go to a particular repeater site and you would feed them?
No. It was all dial-in.
Okay.
Whoever wanted it was first come, first serve. But we were paying, I'll tell you the phone lines we were paying for, okay? We were paying for two outgoing lines in the Los Angeles area, okay, with long distance service, although wouldn't take collect calls, but it had long distance accessibility. We had four lines for operating the organization. We still have three. One of them is the line you're talking to me on right now. Another one was a data line, if you remember the old days when you couldn't put a modem on the same line that you talked on before DSL. And I'm trying to remember, and we had a another line which we kept for basically doing engineering lines, you know, an engineering line. So if we were doing an interview with somebody and I had somebody recording in another area, I could talk to them while doing an interview. So it was we were supporting the phone company pretty well. We had phone bills up in the $500-$600 range some months.
And let me ask you this question. How in the world did you guys fund all this? I mean, in order to be able to, I mean, that's a lot of expense.
Originally, it was Bill Orenstein and Bill Pasternak just funding it. We just did it. I mean, when in the days when Jim Hendershot was involved, we didn't have that much to do. I mean, it was, you know, Jim would do most of it, and there was no money involved. And it started to get bigger and bigger. Of course, costs came in, and a wonderful man came into our life, Norm Chalfin, late Norm Chalfin, K6PGX. And one day, he was a patent attorney at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out here in Pasadena, California. He says, I'm going to start a support fund for you guys. And I said, okay. And I remember what I said before, never said turn anybody down, right? And he did. He started up a support fund for us, and we were getting in, wow, $30, maybe $40 a month to help offset the cost. And it was still costing us a lot of money, but, you know, then it's kept, and as more and more people heard about it, and heard about the need. And Norm was a wonderful fundraiser, and he was the one who basically cut our costs in half. Okay, Bill Orenstein and I were still shelling out money on this, but it was manageable at that point. And that's the way it was. And then Billy got married and got involved with, you know, family and new job and stuff like that. And then eventually, unfortunately, his marriage didn't last, and he moved to Hawaii. He retired for health reasons, and he left our organization. In the meantime, other people had come aboard. Jim Davis, W2JKD, is his call now, but he's had a lot of calls, and I've known Jim from New York from the old days on the WA2SUR repeater in New York City, and he was Big Boz Evans on WPLJ.
And in Detroit, he was Big Jim Edwards.
Big Jim Edwards. Yeah, I've often kidded him. I said, you had the world's most normal American name, Jim Davis. Why'd you change it? I don't know. You know, Jim's one of the neat, as you know Jim, and you know he's one of the nicest people in the whole wide world.
One of the most talented on-air people grace the microphones of CKLW in Detroit. Unbelievable talent.
Yeah, anyway, Jim moved to Los Angeles to become PD. I better explain that to you, program director at Gene Autry Station. I'm trying to remember the call, just went totally blank. Anyway, and his job was to get rid of music and make it an all-talk station. And since he was out here and we were friends, he said, I'll cut some for you. So he did, and he became one of the two voices of Westlink Radio, and the other voice was a gentleman who's now long gone, Alan Call, W6RCL, who was a news writer at the time when I met him. He was a news writer and field producer for KNBC News. He eventually became the, what do you call it? He was the bureau chief for NBC Network News in Amman, Jordan. And Alan was basically almost from the day I moved to Los Angeles to the day we went to his memorial almost 3 years ago now. 2 years ago. 2 years ago he passed away. He was one of my closest, dearest, most wonderful friends, one of the people who affected my life an awful lot. There were a couple like that. Roy Neal, K6DUE, NBC's, they called him the science reporter. Actually, his title was network correspondent and network producer. And, of course, my buddy Dave Bell, who he and I are the last of that crowd, I guess, because it was Dave Bell, Roy Neal, Alan Call, myself, and Frosty Oden. Frosty works over at CBS Sullivan City. He was an editor. He's now a manager over there. How time flies, right?
Goodness.
And so we're the ones who did a lot of the, well, almost all of the film and video between Dave before I ever came out here, and then Dave and Roy, and then Dave, Roy, and me, and then Dave Moyer, then Roy, myself, and Alan, and Frosty, and now back kind of like the Dave and me. It's kind of got, you know, as people have unfortunately become Silent Keys. Dave, Bell, and myself are the last of that group that did almost all the films and videos. Dave did almost everything on film and then helped us when we were doing stuff on video. We did the Roy Neal and myself and Forrest Yoden did the and Alan Call did the very first ham radio piece ever done on videotape. So, but we're getting off the Newsline thing and I want to get back to that. But people just keep coming in. It grew on its own. We never, ever, ever tried to make it what it has become. Never in a million years. It was never our thought to be anything but this little organization in Los Angeles that was doing a newscast for the local people, and it just grew to a national and then an international newscast, and now we're all over the world. And to this moment, I really can't figure out how it got that big.
Well, you know, you were saying you didn't want to get too far off the beaten path, but I want to take a quick excursion, and that is I want you to tell folks a little bit about some of the professional broadcast projects that you've been part of.
Well, let's see. I was a radio brat, as you know. We've talked about this. I've worked radio stations. Okay, let me go back. I was a kid, and one afternoon, I wanted to. I don't know why I did this. I have no idea. I think it was a Saturday. It must have been because I would have been in school during the week. You know, I'm talking about being 13, 14, 15 years old, probably about 15. I took the subway into Manhattan, lived in Brooklyn. Went over to Channel 5, I think it was still WABD. And in those days, you know, you could walk into, it was before the days of high security, you could walk into a TV station. I walked in, found somebody, I didn't know who he was at the time, and it's an interesting story as to who this was, his name was Arthur Forrest. And I walked up to this guy, walked into the station, there was no guards. Went up, because I knew that I'd been there once before to see a show. I remember there was a studio on the third floor, I think it was. Took the elevator up, walked in, and there were some people walking around, and I walked over to this guy, and I said, how do I get a job working here? And he says, grab a broom. And that's how I got started. So, my life has been, I've been on both sides of it. I've fixed television sets for a living, and I've made the shows that go on to them, and I've kept stations on the air, and I've worked in radio, I've worked in television, and I've loved every minute of it. As a matter of fact, I'm working on a chapter for the book I'm working on now, and I think I'm going to call it Please Don't Tell My Boss I'm Having This Much Fun. I mean, and you have to, if you're in this business, you do it because you love it. You never, in our day, when I got into this, it wasn't for the money, it was for the love.
You're listening to QSO. We'll be back with our guest, WA6ITF Bill Pasternak, right after this. It's the 4040. It's a new 40-meter monoband antenna. It looks just like the Adventurer or the TW2010. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installation where you gotta go stealth. 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Just attach the feed line and you're ready to talk. That's the Trans World Adventurer 4040. Go to their website. Take a look. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95.
$399.95.
That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadristand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email, and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now on QSO, back to our guest, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. But for the folks that are listening that are curious, what are some of the television shows and things that they would be familiar with that you've worked at behind the scenes?
Let's see. We're going back to when I first got with the company I worked for, I just retired from, which was Fox Television, but when I went to work for it was Metro Media Television, okay? And some of the shows, One Day at a Time, The Facts of Life, most of the T.A.T. Tandem shows that were done, Breakaway, I don't know if anybody ever heard of that one, The Wilton North Report, a lot of big shows and a lot of stuff that didn't last very long. It's typical of it. One of the first things I didn't really work on, but one of my first assignments was something that I absolutely to this day love. And I should start by saying that my wife and I are love live theater, live musical theater. Okay, but one of the things I was actually on my first day there was they taped Baryshnikov on Broadway, Mikhail Baryshnikov, and I sat there in the control room and my mouth was hanging out watching this being done because one of the things that happened in my life many years before that was. That when I was in high school, I got into this English class, which is a story unto itself, but my English class, and this is 1957, my theater/film English class was at opening night of West Side Story at the Winter Garden Theater in Manhattan.
Wow.
And that kind of set the tone, I think, for a lot of things that's happened in my life ever since.
That's incredible. That would be.
We didn't know what it was though. You got to understand. We got a bunch of 15, 16-year-olds. We were going to a show. We had an English class that we would go to shows or go to movies, and then we'd talk about them and write compositions. I remember compositions before reports, you know. And so we had no idea what it was, but what we know is we were something. We saw our pictures in the next day. They had a picture of all of us with the cast. In the centerfold of the New York Daily News, and I'd love to have a copy of that, but that's gone, unfortunately.
I want to get back to Newsline, but by the same token, you've accomplished a lot. You've worked a lot in the broadcast industry. That's been your life.
It's been my fun.
When you were working, let's say, on a television set like One Day at a Time, what did you do for that show?
I was actually downstairs. I was not up on stage. Mm-hmm. When I went to work in those days, when I was first went to work for Metro Media, I was hired in to fix 3/4-inch U-matic video recorders. Now, I don't know how many people know what a 3/4-inch U-matic is, but if you remember Betamax and VHS machines, it was the grown-up version. It used it was an earlier version, and it used a piece of tape and a cartridge that was three quarters of an inch wide. And because of the way it loaded, it looked like the letter U. So Sony Corporation, which invented it, called it U-Matic. And they were very complex. I mean, they're, and I have always loved working on electromechanical devices. So I hired in to fix, what happened was a guy who was there, who had been doing this for a couple of years, up and quit. And they had nobody, and my buddy Bert Hicks at WV6MQV was working at the station. He had called me for some reason, and all of a sudden his boss walked in, late Lee Pardee, was chief engineer at the station slash manager of Metro Tape West. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to Lee, who I did know casually, and he says, you know how to fix those slant track? He called them slant track machines. I said, well, you mean U-Matic? Yeah, I worked on them. He says, good, come and see me. I said, well, I don't want to work. I've got my own business. I don't want to work on it. I don't want to work for a station. He says, come and see me. I need some help. Okay. Okay, Lee, I'll come down. And he says, he interviews me and a couple others. And the next thing I know, he says, can you work for me 3 or 4 weeks? I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And that kind of stretched into just shy of 30 years. So I worked originally. My original job was fixing video recorders, 3/4 inch. I don't know if anybody remembers 2-inch quad machines, Ampex 1000s, Ampex 1500s, 1600s, Ampex 2000s, and then 1-inch Type C machines, and Betacam came along. And I that was basically my job. Then about halfway through that career, I got involved with the news department at KTTV. That's just about the time that Metro Media was sold to Rupert Murdoch and became part of the flagship station. We became the flagship station for the Fox Television Network. And one of the things that we had each employee had to decide was, do you want to go to the network or do you want to stay at the local level? And I didn't really feel like traveling. I didn't feel like doing a lot of the things I knew was going to happen. So I just decided to stay at the local station, figured I'd stay there another year or two and look for something. I wanted to go back into business for myself, which never happened. I wound up in a very interesting position. I became the go-between between the engineering department and the news department. And if I may say so, I think my job was mainly keep the news directors out of the engineering director's office. As long as he didn't get complaints, he was happy. And that was basically what I did for until I retired. I was in excited for the last year when I was involved with the HD conversion, the digital conversion. But I even still did my news. But basically, I was doing, and if you want to, I don't know what else to call it other than quality control. But I was involved with live newscasts at 10 to 11 p.m. at night. So I'd go into work at 4 in the afternoon, work till midnight. And then about 6 years ago, I guess, they became a duopoly and bought out another station in town, moved the station over. So there was a 11 to 11:30 newscast. So I was starting to work from, I think it was 4:30 to 12:30, you know. Never minded it because I've always had swing shift hours in radio and television before, so it was always home to me. I didn't matter. But most of my time in television was spent in television news, the engineering side of news, doing every conceivable job from going out and running a live truck to being on set. We had robotic cameras for the past 10 years, and every now and then the robotic cameras, one of them would decide not to operate, and you couldn't do anything during the show, so I'd put on the headset and become a camera operator. Well, I'd done that before, you know. So you name the job, in the technical end, I've done it. And the other thing I did with the news department, I was their guy to go to, their in-house electronics expert. They did pieces on electronics or on emergency communications. I was the go-to guy, and I wound up doing the on-camera with one of the reporters, and mostly usually working with reporters who are close friends of mine. So I've been on in front of the camera, behind the camera, and of course I also, thanks to Dave Bell and Roy Neal and Alan, wound up as producer-director on a lot of stuff, both amateur radio and non-amateur radio, outside of my regular job. So and writing and producing and directing. So you name it, I've done the job. My fun was a lot of the times during with the sitcoms was I would usually go up on stage during the breaks and have lunch or something with the dinner with the crew and something. But we were during those days, we kind of were buried down in the basement of Metro Media Square.
When you were in the middle of working, I mean, which the you know this type of job, what you're doing is a pretty intensive thing. And it's very demanding. It's also it also can be a high stress job. So, how in the world did you fit in all of the work for Amateur Radio Newsline while you were doing that?
To this day, I don't know. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that we had a bunch of hams down at work, and a couple of them, Bob Sudock, WB6FDF, who was my boss, one of my bosses, had earlier on done the newscast for a local repeater long before there was. The Westlink Radio News, there was the Mount Wilson Repeater Association News Bulletin, and Bob used to do that from his home. And Bob had training in that, so he was one of, became one of the voices and one of the helped me write stuff. And so I had a little help at work, and my former chief engineer, who's unfortunately now gone, Lee, he gave us permission. We actually had our equipment. I guess we can tell it all now because I don't work for the company. But for many years, the cart machine that you were accessing was sitting down at Metro Media Square in Hollywood in a closet that we had permission to put it there. And we had our own phone line there. So I had a lot of support up until the time it became Fox. When it became Fox, it became very New York corporate, and a lot of that went away. But it just always had people in the industry who liked what we were doing, and we all just got together. I don't think that you know, people say, Bill, you didn't. No, it was everybody. It was Jim Davis. It's David Black. I mean, I can go on and on. Warren Ellie, all the people, Bob Suda, everybody pitched in. I mean, we just lost our treasurer, Andy Jarema, passed away about 2 months ago. Andy came to us originally as a voice of Newsline, or actually was still Amateur Radio, Westlink Amateur Radio, and when Norm Chalfin was forced to retire and decided to get out of everything, Andy took over and became the voice of fundraising for Newsline. I mean, it was just one thing after another. It was never we had to go and ask. It was people coming to us. That's how it happened. I may have been the pivot point or the central point, whatever you want to call it. But I never did it alone, and I'm never going to ever say I did it alone. It was all these other people who made it possible.
Well, now as Newsline progressed, you know, and as it began to spread across the country and get aired on various repeaters, and then obviously too online MP3 downloads, people linking to it, and of course it began to spread. During that time, I guess my question is what changes did you notice? What was going on then, or how did it change from where it was to where it is today?
Well, the technical changes I just explained to you, and then, of course, we introduced, as I said, MP3 audio, and that's been our standard. And, of course, we still maintain one machine because this afternoon I got a call from a guy up in Michigan, as a matter of fact, come to think of it. I don't remember the town. He said that he was just outside Skagit or something like that. Anyway, and he wanted to know the phone number because he was at a friend's house who had no computer. And he wanted to demonstrate Newsline to the guy. Did we still have a phone? I said, yes. Gave him the number, 661-296-2407. I said, that's the only phone line we have left. Because we don't get that many calls anymore, obviously. The Internet has changed that. But he said, thank you. And I'm going to myself, my God, people are actually still interested. Yeah. The numbers we hit are phenomenal. Which, you know, the only reason I know these numbers, and I'm going to tell you this now, and this is because our current hosting company, which is a company in here in Los Angeles called Allen Labs, C-Sphere, and they keep something we never did before. They automatically keep records, you know, not who calls it, but just totals. And it boggles my mind to tell you that there are weeks we get over 9,000 people downloading the audio newscast.
Now, repeat that number again.
We get over 9,000. I mean, when I saw it, I said, no, it can't be. And I called Ron. I said, Ron, no. He says, the numbers are automatic. They don't lie. That's not every week, though, but that was the week that King Hussein passed away. And I think that was the one that one. And there's been a couple that have hit the 8,000, 9,000 mark. But normally, I've logged in, and any given time, it's usually over 6,000, but we have hit that over 9,000 download thing. So that is, you know, when you figure, you know, that many people listening to you, and it becomes a responsibility. You really feel that, you know, and again 9,000, let's say 6,000, okay, whatever, okay? Multiply that, if it's a repeater, by 50, 60 people. That's a big audience. There are radio stations that wish to have the audience that we have.
That's absolutely true. Now, you know, when I guess my question is what drove you into this? In other words, this has to be, for someone to put this much work and effort week after week after week, and not just you, but there's a lot of other people, but you personally, for you to put so much time in, what was the motivating factor? What was it that makes makes you want to produce so much effort? And I know that there are folks, you know, like you and I, that really love the hobby, and we're looking for a way to restore to the hobby things that the hobby has given to us, or repay, or pay it back, or pay it forward, or however. Tell me a little bit about that. I know there's a story behind that, because you had sent me an email once, but
right.
You're listening to QSO. We'll be back with our guest, WA6ITF Bill Pasternak, right after this. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna. And it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And check out the special pricing right now. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. And we'll look for your email. And now on QSO, back to our guest, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
Well, let's go back to late 1950s, early 60s, mid-1950s. My mom in the late 50s, my mom, Blanche Pasternak, we were still living in Brooklyn. I was still living at home at the time. I was a kid. And she got sick. Didn't know what it was. In those days, medical research hadn't gotten to where it is today, of course. And after about a year and a half, they finally found that she was suffering from terminal non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, basically form of cancer. And it was not good news, obviously. I was very close with my mom. My mom and I were very close. I was never very close with my dad. I'm not talking out of shop, because the world knows this. I mean, I've talked about this before. My father came from the old country, and he was never Americanized. I was on the other side. On the other hand, I was brought up in Brooklyn. I'm a street kid, so I was, anyway. The upshot was that my mom really got, we used the term, went terminal. Guess it was like June of 1959, right after I graduated high school. It was right after I graduated high school, June, July. And so the next year or so, I spent helping my dad and my brother take care of my mom. My brother was 4 years younger than me, so at the time I was, 16, so he was like 12, 13. He was about 13, 14, something. So anyway, and this was a year, and what happened was my father had to go to work. Would go to work, and I would stay home and take care of my mother's needs, and my brother would come home from school finally, and he would come home from school, and he'd take over and do what he could, and I would take a couple hours off to go to my friend's store just so I could get out of the house. And then I would come home, and my father would go to sleep for a couple of hours. Okay, and I would basically stay up most of the night. Being a night owl, I was always a night owl, and I would take care of mom's needs, and then he'd get up and take care of a couple hours and go back off to work, and then my brother would take over so I could get a couple of hours sleep. He'd go off to school or to play, and I would take over again. So this was this routine, and the only way for me to stay up at night was to stay on the air. And in those days, I was on 6 meter AM with a... what was I running? Well, various radio stuff I had built or what have you. Most of the time with a little radio sitting right next to me. I've had all these years. A Clegg 99 from Ed Clegg, W2LLY, gave me, 1960. It was a prototype. It doesn't even have a Clegg meter in it. It has a Lafayette radio meter. It's a one of a kind, I guess. Anyway, and a couple of my friends knew about my mom's condition. I didn't tell everybody. I told my friend Larry Levy, John Peterson, a couple of close friends. And they told a couple of their friends, obviously. And I'd have to stay up at night. If I didn't have something to keep me up, so I'd stay on the air. And these people, these hams, Larry, WA2INM, John, WA2FMF, I could go back, the calls, just, keep... Every now and then, a person will just appear in my memory. Dave Kahn on WA12FK, who's no longer a ham, but he's still a close friend of mine. These people stayed with me all night. They keep me awake. They were my friends. They were my support group. They call cancer families have support groups. These were my support group. My friends, Archie K2MOO with his little moo cow. Al, WA2ERX, most of these people, I don't even know what happened to them. And these were the people who were there for me. And I made a pledge to myself. I said, someday, if I can find a way to repay this kindness, and this was kindness, this to me, in the time of when I needed something, when I needed support, these were the people who were there. They were hams. A lot of them didn't even know me personally. They were there. They were there for me. They knew that I needed something, and they were there. That's the way ham radio was. at least the way it was on 6 meters in Brooklyn, New York in 1959 through 1960. My mom died September 26, 1960. And when we were, it was amazing who showed up at her funeral, friends of mine, and and there to support me. Literally there to support me. I've told you this before. And as a result, I just made a vow to myself, someday I'm going to find a way to repay the kindness. Maybe not to the same people, maybe I won't be able to, but at least do something. I don't know what that something is, but I'm going to do something to say thank you. And I think, and I'm not sure, I think Newsline, what we called Westlink Radio and now Newsline, I think maybe that's my way of saying thank you. I don't know. It's just, I feel that it's something that I have to do. Not that I don't want to do it, because I enjoy it. I wouldn't do anything I didn't enjoy. But it's something I feel that, hey, these people were there for me. Maybe I can do something to help their lives.
It's the whole idea that this wonderful hobby that is there for so many people.
Camaraderie.
That you want to make sure that you do something to help preserve that hobby, so it's there for someone else today as well as tomorrow and, you know, 10 years from now.
I mean, it's we're all in this for the same reason, aren't we?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I lost my dad when I was real young, and I was an only child, and my room was in the basement of the house, and, of course, I had radio gear there. And, matter of fact, at one point in time, there was a pastor from a local church that I was attending that took me down to Arlington, Texas to look at a Bible college. And while I was down there, he said, well, there's a bunch of ham equipment that belongs to the school, and he said they're not using it. I think I'm going to load this up in the bus, and you can bring it home. So we went and grabbed the stuff, and it was a Globe Champ 300.
Wow.
A Hallicrafters SX-100.
I had one of those at one time.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. I mean, that was basically the station. I think there was a phone patch box.
Probably a Dow key relay, I bet.
Yeah, a fellow had wired up and made. And then there was a trapped dipole that was all rolled up in the feed line and everything. And so we loaded all that onto the bus, and I brought it home and set it up. And it was, you know, that was my, I guess I want to say, beginnings. Now, I had been exposed to ham radio prior to that from a couple of hams, and I was just, you know, itching, you know, to be able to get some equipment and get on the air. But, of course, once again, I was an only child. My dad had passed away when I was young, so I, you know, but now here's the thing. You know, what was weird about this whole deal is that I could walk into my room at night, and there was no brothers and sisters or anything like that. And when I would come home and you open the door to your room and sit down and turn on that radio, you were literally walking in to a threshold that could take you to any place on the planet.
Well, in my case, it was any place in the tri-state area because it was 6 meters. But, yeah, exactly the same thing.
And there were people. There were people up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning around.
There still are. There still are. That's the other thing. You know, it's they're not as easy to find as they used to be, but there are still people around my friend, the late Gene Shepherd, called the night people.
Uh-huh.
I was a night person. I still remember Gene. I remember on the radio as a kid, I used to have a RCA two-pipe portable radio. I'd sneak under the blankets and I'd listen to Gene Shepherd. If you weren't a kid in the tri-state area, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But he was the gentleman who we're talking about. The guy who wrote and produced the classic Christmas A Christmas Story. You know, a little Ralphie about shooting his eye out. And well, he had a radio show in New York City on WOR, and a lot of us discovered it, and we became night owls. We became children of the dark, or he just called us night people, and we were followers of Shep. And we didn't know he was a ham at the time. I found out later on he was a ham, but K2ORS. That was my initial exposure, and probably prompted me a little bit towards broadcast business, I think. But yeah, there was people all over at night, and it was a different kind of people. If you remember, The people at night were different from the people during the day. People at night were more in tune with the people they were talking with. It wasn't just, hi, your signal report is such and such. You really got to know the people at night, the all-nighters, the people who were on late at night. Maybe they were driving home from their job at midnight and had a two-hour drive and you kept them company or what have you. Those people became your friends. Those are the people you got to know. Or if you went to, you know, if you were a school kid like I was and you got to know kids after school, and then you'd meet them locally and you'd go on hidden transmitter hunts and things like that. I'm still friends with many of the, quote, kid hams, the, you know, kids, teenagers that I met on 6 Meter AM are still a part of my life.
Well, you know, it was interesting because I got on HF when I got licensed, and as I would travel around the country, it was almost like you had a friend in every city. And, I mean, people that you knew relatively well because you would talk to them so much, you know. And it was kind of strange. You know, it was a whole different feel that gave the whole United States a different feel because regardless of where you went, there was somebody you knew. And you could meet those people and have dinner. A lot of times they'd ask you to come over. But let me ask you this now. I don't want to get into a negative thing, but I'm going to go down this road because I think it's a road that needs to be traveled.
Go.
And that is, what changes have you seen in the hobby, you know, that at this point in time you wish you could maybe roll them back?
First of all, I don't think there's anything I would roll back because you can't change time. You can't hold back progress. What I see is, in the hobby is the same thing I see in society, the need for instant gratification. Everything must be here now, must be this way, that way. The patience is gone, okay? People get upset. I'm not a big DXer, but I like to listen sometimes. I have my 847 in my vertical outside on the patio, and I'll be listening to a D-Expedition, and I listen to the rudeness by which stations call the DX. It wasn't that way in the old days. I'd listen. In the old days, people helped each other. One guy would work and say, okay, we'll stand by for my friend Joe, and then one right after another. Now it's dog-eat-dog. That's the kind of thing that I've noticed. It's got to be instant. I've got to be top. I've got to be top dog. I've got to be right on top. Nobody should be better than me. That's not the way it was when I got into the hobby. Hey, I'll help you. That's the thing that I notice most. Can you turn it back? It would be nice to, but you can't because society has changed. Everything now, you know, I think telecommunications in general, the changes in the telecommunications industry that have brought internet, have brought television, have brought you name it into the house, have also brought in that need for instant gratification. And you have two or three generations now who have known nothing more than instant gratification, so it's not going to get any better.
I guess the thing of it is that in terms of, you're talking about operating courtesy, and I can honestly say that to me is an issue. But it seems to me that when you would get on ham radio years ago, people actually enjoyed what they were doing. In other words, it was like you got kind of captivated into the conversation, and you would have full-scale conversations. And
yeah, and you still do. It depends on where you are. If you go onto a repeater, for example, that is just involved itself in nothing more than MCOM, emergency communications, you're not going to have a good time because people there are just, you know, the concept of having the repeater be silent all the time, waiting for that emergency, which will never happen. You know that thing. But I happen to belong to a group of people who sit on a repeater, and we're all broadcasters, and we're debating. I mean, long before the public knew about digital television, we were debating HVSB versus COFDM, and we were having a great time. It was something because we all had a commonality. I think that what's happened, and not so much on the HF bands, but on VHF, the repeaters have done two things. They've been a wonderful melting pot, to bring people together. They've also shown the fact that not everybody has something in common with everybody else, and that's true. I think you know that as well as I do. That, you know, you're talking, for example, on an open repeater on 2 meters, and you're talking about, the future of digital television, and somebody comes in and wants to get a signal report. Well, that's killed your time of thought, and you just want to walk away from it, you know? The concept of having a rag chew on the HF bands is gone. I don't hear that anymore. You hear what? You hear nets, and you hear people working each other high, 5x9, 73. Everybody's 5x9. You can't hear the guy. He's 5x9, you know? It's the concept of just making a contact for the sake of making a contact. And that's not the ham radio I got into. I got into ham radio to have fun, to talk to people, to get to know people, to make friends. And that's been my life. My life has been making friends. And it's very hard to do that on HF. It really is very hard to do on HF. And getting that way on VHF also, because of everything's becoming, quote, special interest.
Well, I guess what gets me is I logged into a repeater here locally and tossed my call sign out. And living in Tennessee, I'll tell you something. I hate Simplex only because when you're mobile, it's the conversations are, what, 15, maybe 15 minutes. It's you're gone. You know, I mean, you've just crossed over a hill. It's gone.
Well, that's the nature of line of sight communications.
So anyhow, I got on the local repeater and I was talking to someone, and a fellow broke in and he said, "Well, if you're just going to talk like you're talking right now, we'd ask that you move over to a simplex frequency. We like to leave the repeater open for folks from out of town." And I said, "Well, I'm originally from Detroit. Does that count?" Anyways, but it was just so unnerving. I thought, well, this is just crazy.
I'll give you the corollary to that.
Okay.
I used to own a repeater in New York City in Brooklyn. It was the first split 15 kilohertz tertiary frequency repeater in the country, WA2ZWP, before there were repeat licenses, okay? And one afternoon, I'm up at the repeater site. Because in the days of tube-type repeaters like televisions that they were always breaking. Remember those days? Yeah, I always change a tube here and there. I'm up the repeater side. I had the transmitter off because I was actually changing out the 6146 finals. I had the receiver on. I had the local audio tuner go. And I hear somebody ka-chunk trying to get into the repeater. Of course, it's not going to come back to them because it's off the air. And he goes, ka-chunk, 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 and nothing, of course, you know. And no ID. Finally, this voice comes on. "Oh, my God, the repeater portion of my radio must be broken." I'm not going to say who it was because the guy's still around. Oh, my God. Has it gotten to this level? And this was 1968 when we had six-channel radios maximum.
But you were talking.
I know where you're coming from, and I understand what you're coming from. Repeaters tend to be very clickish, clannish, with some exceptions. Either clickish and clannish, or they're weird. We have, as you're probably aware, we have one out here which is calls itself the Animal Farm, and I won't go into it, but it's not a place I hang out. I don't operate very much on 2 meters anymore anyway. I'm mostly on the UHF bands, and I tend to like to listen. I'm one of the places, if you want to find me, listen around 28.4. If the band is open, I'll be there. I like 10 meters. I like 10, 15, 12. Because I'm using a small vertical antenna and living in a condo, so I don't have very good antennas. But you don't have to fight the big gun DX stations that way. You can actually on those bands even have a queue, so if the other station wants it. But more and more I'm hearing this, you know, if I turn on my radio, well, at this hour I'm not going to hear much. But if I turn on my radio now, in the afternoon and the band was open, you'll be hearing stations work each other in almost like in contest fashion. There's no humanity to it. It's a contact to get a card. Goodbye. Hello. I'm Ralph. QRZ. Goodbye. That to me isn't ham radio.
Well, I'm glad I've got you on because, and the reason why I say this is because, first off, you never have a problem expressing what you feel, and you've been in amateur radio long enough at this point and have paid the dues to where, you know, you can kind of call the shots the way they are. But you know, one of the things that really kind of bothers me is you were talking about working UHF. Well, I've got a couple of UHF radios here, and both of my sons have UHF and whatnot, and the first radio I ever bought that had UHF on it, I jumped on a 450 machine here in town, and my very first contact, there was a fellow in there talking, so I tossed my call sign out, and he came back to me, And within 60 seconds, and I won't say the fella's call, but he jumped in and he said, the National Weather Service office monitors this repeater. And if you're going to chit-chat, we'd appreciate it if you'd move off this frequency and go elsewhere. Well, there was a group of machines that were tied together. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. And I just thought, boy, this is real pleasant. This is the first...
We call those channel cops.
Well, you know, this
they have that. It's their stay in life to make life miserable for everybody else. That's all it is.
Well,
think about it. What are they doing? My God, there's somebody there. He shouldn't be there because I say he shouldn't be there, so he shouldn't be there. You know, I've gotten to a point where I tell people like that, hey, get a life. get a life.
Well, yeah, but it was really interesting. I was at a ham fest, and there's a fellow that I know that was from Watertown. He's always got interesting things to sell. He's just one of those fellas. He's at all the ham fests where he gets the stuff. I don't know. I don't ask any questions. Anyways, we're standing there, and there was a rig that was a dual bander, and it had 2 meters and 440 on it. And the fellow standing next to me said, well, the 440 portion of it doesn't mean anything to me at all. And I said, why is that? He said, well, you can't talk on it. He said, all the repeater police are up there, and they'll run you off. And they'll admonish you about the National Weather Service listening to this frequency. And you know what? God bless the National Weather Service. I'm glad they monitor. I wouldn't want to get in their way in any way, shape, or form. And if the sky turned dark, I'd be the first one to shut up and go away. I mean, it's just common sense, you know. And this fellow began to tell me the story, his story. And it was identical to my story. And then the gentleman that had the radio for sale said, yep. He said, I don't operate up there either. He said, I got chewed out too. And so here we were, three local guys standing here, exchanging a horror story about, as you call it, an amateur radio security guard with his badge pinned to his chest, you know, policing the frequencies. And I got to thinking about that. And I thought, well, that's just, you know, it's so unfortunate. But by the same token, I guess... maybe I'm just stupid for paying any attention to the guy. I should have just kept right on talking, you know, and ignored him, you know.
Well, if he was a control operator, he may have turned the repeater off on you, though.
Well, you know, it was really interesting because we took care of a chief engineer for a group of radio stations, and one of the repeaters from this operation happened to be in our transmitter building with my permission. And my son, Matt, was with me, and these guys were talking on this machine, and we were, you know, we're on this big top of this big hill, this 1,000-foot tower over the top of us, and he jumped on the repeater. He says, is there any bad weather coming this way? And he said, he gave his location. And the same guy got on there and said, this is an emergency weather net. But it wasn't even a weather net at that point. It was just a bunch of guys talking. They hadn't called a net at that point in time. And he said, this is for emergency purposes only, da-da-da-da-da. And so Matt went back to him and said, okay, fine. I am at the repeater site, and I'm pulling the plug on the repeater. And he did. And I clapped my hands, and I said, there you go. I said, this is how you handle this kind of thing, you know. But I guess the thing of it is, the message I would have at this point is to hams that run into this kind of thing, and that is, don't let it bother you. Don't get like I did. You know, I got offended by it. And the thing of it is don't be offended. Just keep right on trucking, because you've got just as much a right to be there if you're behaving yourself as anyone else does. And
yeah,
enjoy.
If it's an open repeater, and I agree with you to this extent. If the repeater is open, if it doesn't require club membership, or if it's not a private system, we have out in California, 450 is 95% private systems. If it's an open repeater, hey, you know, you don't restrict an open repeater. Period.
The other thing, I was in town and I was passing through. There was a weather net on, and I was just listening. And the fellow who was conducting the net had gone silent for a pretty good period of time. I would say in excess of 7 or 8 minutes. There hadn't been any transmissions at all. And lo and behold, a fellow pops in and he gives his call sign. And immediately, the fellow that had started the net jumped in and just chewed this guy out. And
Well, then he went back to, you know, silent again. It was silent for another, I can say, maybe 7, 8, maybe even as much as 10 minutes.
Again, I mean, as I call them, and these are the channel cops. They have nothing better in life. They have no reason to exist other than to say, I run this channel. This is, you can't talk here without my permission. You know, that it's stupid, and, you know, but there's not much you can do about it. I mean, my philosophy has always been, as far as repeaters are concerned, okay, why would I want to be where I'm not wanted? Okay? Why would I go put my 2 cents in where nobody wants me? If they don't want me, if they want their little click, fine, have your little click. There's, you know, there's how many megahertz of space and how many thousands of repeaters? There's always a home. There's always a place. Why get involved? I guess I hear these people get so upset. Well, I was told this is a public frequency. Look, the guys don't want you. It could be something very simple. They might not like a guy. You know, they may be something where the guy rubs them the wrong way.
There you go.
You know, and they just don't want them. So, fine. Believe me, you go someplace else, you're going to find a group of people to talk to. Why get upset over something stupid? That's my philosophy.
The thing of it is, there's a lot of new hams, a lot of new guys getting in, a lot of the technicians and that whatnot are just discovering, you know, VHF, UHF, and the only reason I even mention these things is to let somebody like yourself speak their mind too, and that is to tell these folks, don't get discouraged, and don't worry about if you're not wanted, go somewhere else, because there will be another friendly group somewhere.
I'll revert back to my love of musical theater many years ago. Your good man Charlie Brown on Broadway. I happened to be in New York, and I caught it. And Kristen Chenoweth, who's a phenomenal singer, built quite a career for herself since then, sang a song called "That's My Philosophy," and everything new, every word from everybody else was a new philosophy, and that's really what it is. Repeaters, every guy who owns a repeater has his philosophy as how he's going to run it. So search one out that meets your philosophy and go with it, and don't worry about it. I mean, again, as I say, why go where you're not wanted?
Well, you know, it's the same thing. It's the same thing on HF, and I, matter of fact, I remember back a couple years ago or whenever it was, hearing fellas that would check in on a 75 meter net at night, and immediately the fellas in that particular group would identify that person as a no code general, you know, and really say some things that were, you know, really just belittle the fella. You know?
Oh, you haven't been on the internet lately. This is another thing that really bothers me. Since you brought it up, I'm going to, you know, something. We're all hams. It doesn't matter whether you pass the code test or not. I have to pass the code test many, 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 many years ago. Big deal. So I passed it. What does it prove? I can memorize Morse code. Big deal. Who cares? Okay. I enjoy it once in a while. I don't use it that often. I got into the hobby to talk to people, to use my voice to talk to people. That's one of the reasons I'm not really involved in digital modes. I like to talk to people. And that's me, okay? But there's something for. Putting labels on people has always been something that's irritated me. And it goes back to an incident that happened back in the 1960s. Two of my ham buddies. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a collision of two airliners. I think it was a TWA Constellation and a United DC-8 over Staten Island. And one of the planes, I think it was the United plane, crashed into part of Brooklyn and took out a whole block, killed a lot of people on the ground, killed almost every. I mean, one little boy survived for a couple of days from it. The first two people on the very first two people on scene, were a couple of my ham buddies. Okay, Larry, W-A-2-I-N-M, and John, then W-2-F-M-F. And there was no other communications for several hours because the phone lines, the telephone poles had been knocked down, you know. So they were the only communications, and in those days, police radios weren't the police radios we know today. So we're talking, you know, mid-60s. And they were on 6 meter AM with car batteries, Gonset communicators, and red wagons, I think, or something like that. You know, it was all red. And they provided most of the communications until they got, you know, the phone company came in, they put temporary lines in and everything fine, and the kids went home, and that was it. I was in college. I was in my first year of college when that happened. So it would have been 64, 65, something like that. I can look it up on the internet. And when it came time for the mayor of New York had wanted to honor everybody who was involved, and these two kids, two younger hams, teenagers, were told by the older hams involved in the ARES group, or they're called AREC, I think, at the time, don't you dare show up because it's not for kids to be there. These are the two who did all the work, you see, okay? They showed up, and boy, that caused a problem in New York. I'll tell you that much. Among the senior people at the time in AREC, which I think all of them are probably deceased by now, but they didn't want anybody who was a youngster, a young whippersnapper, to have any credit for anything. That's the way it was, and it's no different than what you see here on repeaters or on HF with somebody being a channel cop or a frequency cop. There is no difference. Everybody thinks that they're more important, and they're not.
Well, you know, I would think that when people engage in a conversation in a QSO, the first thing I would think is I would think that when they come on a frequency, they would want folks to like them, or they would want to be liked, you know, on a frequency. And of course, if you do, when you come on, when you're in a conversation with someone else, the more you focus on the other person, the more you're going to be liked. I mean, if you're asking questions about their family or their vocation or whatever they're doing, and you bother to listen and learn about them, it makes that other person feel like they're important, and they're gonna want to talk to you again sometime. And I agree with you. This, you're 599 and whatever the heck it is, and your grid square is this, and bang, we're off and we're gone. For some folks, I guess maybe that's a good part of the hobby. But I'm like you. I was shown amateur radio by a fellow by the name of Nelson Cosby in Dearborn, Michigan, and he's up in years now. And matter of fact, we went and visited him a couple of years ago and put him on QSO. But he showed me his station when I was just a kid. And he had a Heathkit Marauder, an SX 101, and he had a Homebrew 813 linear amplifier and a 20-meter beam. And he basically lived on 20 meters. And everybody he spoke with, he made a point to ask them what their vocation was. What did they do for a living? And it was really interesting. I mean, he asked this religiously because he was just so fascinated with all the different people that are on ham radio and all the different professionals and all the different people that worked in labor and all the different people that just did everything. And he told me, he said, you meet the most amazing people. But see, he would take the time to make that conversation and to talk to those people. And I guess I'd like to suggest that to newer amateurs that are just getting on the air.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Or just, how long you've been married, anything. You just need and something to ice break the ice. Part of it is I think people don't know how to communicate anymore. They don't know how to talk to their own families. You look at the divorce rates nowadays. You know, what is it, 56% of everybody who gets married gets divorced within 3 or 4 years. Come on, there's something wrong with that. You know, and I'm just remembering back when I was. When I was young, when I first got in, I still remember there was a guy up, I think it was upstate New York, W2OY, and he would call something like CQ, 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 no kids, no lids, no space cadets, the school bus doesn't stop on my frequency. He didn't want to talk to kids. He didn't want to talk to younger people.
Well, we had some kids here that were part of the blind school in the Nashville, Tennessee area, and they were promptly run off those 440 machines as well, you know, and... I don't know. I guess I feel like we just need to be more concerned about manners and goodwill, and that's what ham radio is supposed to be all about, is goodwill. And so
I'm going to be very, very, what is it, politically incorrect.
Okay.
If ham radio in general would just adopt the good old Judeo-Christian ethic of being friends to people, of caring about people, all the problems would go away.
Well, that's true, and I don't think we'd have any trouble with the growth of the hobby. You know, no one would be talking about dwindling numbers. And, of course, now that's another thing that people talk about.
Numbers are not dwindling.
Where are we at? We're like 680,000 or something?
Yeah, we actually, according to Rich Moseson, I think we're up like, I have to go look at his one of his recent editorials, but we actually grew by like 10,000 or so over the past year. So we're not doing that bad. You know, you kind of have people... Think ham radio. Oh, everybody's got to be a ham. No, everybody's never going to be a ham. It's something that appeals to a very small cross-section. I'm not going to say elitist, because we're not elitist. We are a small cross-section of people who have an interest in communications, okay? And some people with more money put up bigger stations. You know, that's all it comes down to. Then there's you and me. We don't have a lot of money, so we make do with what we can with it. With my case, I have two transceivers. I have a TS-520, which I would never part with. I love that thing. And I have a more modern FT-847, which is about 10, 12 years old now. So, we make do with what we have. And if you live in a condo like I do, you make do with anything. But you know something? You still talk to people. You still have fun.
You know, I guess the thing of it is that... it is such a wonderful hobby because it encompasses so many things. There's so many facets to it. And the general public, of course, they don't understand and they don't know all the things in their life that they deal with that amateur radio has brought to the table. And I would have to say the two most significant things that I can think of right off the bat have been the cell phone, and number two would be... the concept of TCP/IP, the what runs the internet right now, which was
I think you're way ahead of it. I think what the most significant thing to me is being able to take the human voice and cast it into the ethereal abyss, and then detect it, and all of a sudden it pops out someplace. That I think is the greatest achievement we've ever had. Everything else has been built on that.
That's true. That's true. But I think about it. I was thinking when I was a kid. You know, I've got this little Samsung phone, okay, and I I'm not doing a commercial, but
you're a Samsung phone or two. That's what I have. I love my little Mac. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Well, this one is it's a little black phone. I don't know. It's got a keypad on the front and it slides open. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then there's a keyboard, you know, and
okay. Okay. You got an advanced one. My phone does one thing. It does telephone. That's all I wanted.
Well, my cousin was saying the other day, he went into a cell phone place and they said, "What do you want this phone to do?" He said, "I want it to ring and I want to be able to talk on it." And they said, "Well, hit this one here, and this has got a case." "I don't want a camera." He said, "Well, you can't get one today without a camera." Anyways, I'm amazed because I have internet access on here. I have email on here. I have text messaging on here. And then it's a cell phone. If someone would have walked up to you as a kid and shown you a device like this, what would have been going through your head?
Time travel. No, I would have said, "What era are you from?" You know, I mean, somebody came up with something like that. Let's see, I'm 68, so let's say it hit me when I was 18 with that, okay? I probably would have said, "Wow, you know, where can I buy one?" You know, yeah, I'm a geek. As a matter of fact, the book that I'm writing is called Geek. That's the name of it. But I've always been a technical nerd. I'm the first to admit it. I was one of those kids who grew up and didn't have muscles. So, as my friend Shep used to say, I was one of those kids I didn't wear glasses in those days, I do now. But I was one of those kids who grew up wearing horn-rim glasses, lived in the basement, and spent the year getting the complexion of a fish. So, I still remember the first time I heard that one. But no, that's true. That was me, and all my friends. You see, all my friends were the same way.
Well, you know, it's so amazing because when I was even talking about TCP/IP, the whole concept of the internet, and it's like, you know, I remember when the people used to come door to door and sell Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, and I know Encyclopedia Britannica has an online presence where you can subscribe or whatever.
You can buy the discs.
You know, but
I have a set of Encyclopedia on, I have the Colliers on disc.
But the thing of it is you can almost do as well with Google. I mean, Google is like this.
I do better with Google because it's more up to date.
And I was talking to a pastor friend of mine here not too long ago, and I was asking him. I said, What do you use barn study notes, or what do you use to prepare your Sunday morning service with? He says, Google. He said, I use Google. And basically anything that you can think of that pops into your head in regards to preparing a sermon to deliver in a church service, you know, you talk about Bible verses, historic things, anything
it's
you want.
It's all there.
It's all there.
Everything you need is there.
You know, and to think that this all came, the method by which this is delivered and transported was originally designed by two amateur radio operators.
Two hams, yeah.
So, I mean, and the general public doesn't understand that, and I have to laugh because I have some friends outside of the family, I guess I want to say, that are not, they're kind of family members, but they're mm-hmm. really not. And they look at our group, my two sons, which are radio engineers, myself, and they refer to us as being wackos, you see.
I'm a geek, as I said, I'm a geek, you know. And you know what, I'm proud of it. I wear my, once in a while, I actually put a pocket protector in my pocket just to say I'm a geek.
Well, I was just amazed. I mean, I know this is probably trite, but I was really amazed at logging into the ARRL website and being able to search all the QSTs online.
Isn't that neat? Isn't that neat?
And I've got, right behind me is a bookcase just loaded mm-hmm. with old QSTs, 73 magazines.
Well, why would you want to do that when you can pick it up in 10 seconds?
That's exactly the case.
You mentioned ARL. The moment you mentioned ARL, I just clicked. I happened to have a link to it in my taskbar up in Firefox. And as you said, I clicked it and I was there instantly. Okay? You know, I want to go to Southgate. Click. I'm in England right now. That's how fast it took me to travel to England, right?
Yeah, it is amazing. So I look at our hobby, and I guess the question I have is, what is it? And a lot of people, I don't think this way, but what is it that amateur radio is going to give birth to by starting off with the raw concepts and people developing and working, and the next thing you know, there's another miraculous form of technology that just emerges out of nowhere.
It's only limited by the imagination of the human mind.
Well, you know, that's and that's, I mean, I don't know, when you sit and think about all these things, it's just like the handheld pocket cell phone that kids and teenagers have all across the country, and they have absolutely no clue where it came from or how it even arrived on the scene.
As a matter of fact, I had a little interesting thing. I was as you know, a lot of the broadcasters now have found they can promote their stations by joining Twitter, right? You know, every radio station reporter is told he's got a tweet now, a twat, whatever it is, you know? And I feel sorry for these guys. They've got enough to do. They got to try and get a story. No, you got to tweet it to the world. But I literally, in some cases, had to explain. I guess what it comes down to is that ham radio should be, and to me, it always has been, about friendship, making friends, keeping friends, helping friends, and it's the way I've lived my life. It's the way I have been. It's—I don't know. It's the way my mom and dad brought me up. I guess I don't know, but I guess that's an extension of it. And again, you know, as I said earlier, I'm writing a book about growing up as a kid who couldn't take part in sports and things like that, and was kind of a geek. And how being a geek actually was very successful for me in my life. So, but it's always been based on, hey, if somebody does something nice to you, be nice to them. And that's, I've lived my life that way. And it's not, I don't think at age 68 I'm going to change.
One of the things that you're involved in is the Young Ham of the Year Award.
Yep, one of the things I'm really proud of. It's something that means a lot to me personally.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Now, I've met two of the Young Ham of the Year Award recipients, I think the one I met at Huntsville, the other one it seems like I met at Dayton, or I may have met the other one at Huntsville as well. But tell us a little bit how that got started and what's going on with that this year.
Okay. Let's start. I got a great way to pick it up because what caused it, remember that story I told you a little while ago about the two hams in Brooklyn who helped with the airplane thing and were told that they shouldn't be honored, and they, you know, got me ticked off. Never get Bill ticked off because he never, I'm like an elephant in certain ways. I don't forget. And I always said to myself, you know, in the earlier days of ham radio, in the days when I got in even, I'm sure it was that way before, it was young ham should be talked about but not heard. Oh, have a point to them and say, look, we got a young ham here. But never give them credit for anything. And it really bothered me. And I always said to myself, if I'm ever, ever in that position to do something to change that, I'm going to do it. And thank God, Lord has been good to me and put me in the position to do something. And back in 1986, I'll tell you the story. I've told this before. I get my best ideas for what I write with taking a shower. I'm taking the shower. I said, you know, and the story went through my head about my friends who had worked on, I don't know why it popped in, but they did. I said, you know, there's got to be a way to honor. And at the time, there was really nothing other than a couple. I think it was the Foundation for Amateur Radio Scholarships was about it, and I think the league had one thing, but it was scholarships. There was nothing. There was no way to honor a kid by making it fun for them, you know. And I said, you know something? I'm going to do something about that. And I came up with this idea for an award. And it was supposed to be nothing more than nominate these kids. Me and my friend Bert will pick one and we'll send them a certificate. It just says, you know, honoring this young person as for what he or she has done as a young ham. That was going to be it. I had no plans for it to be any more than that. Later that same day, I was talking to Chip Margelli, K7JA. At the time, he was with Yaesu, long before it was Vertex Standard. We're talking 1986. And I said to him, Chip, I said, let me run this idea behind. I had recorded an interview with him. I think he had just come back from China or something. I said, let me run this idea behind. It's, what do you think of it? And I told him what I had for this idea, and he says, count us in. I said, what do you mean count you in? He says, we'll underwrite it. What do you want to do with it? We'll underwrite it. Okay, I mean, what do we do? He said, we'll give them a radio. Do you want to have another? I said, yeah, let's do that. Okay, fine. So that's how the Young Ham of the Year Award was born, and that's how Yaesu, which is now Vertex Standard, got involved, and they've been with us ever since. Wonderful bunch of people. And here's something funny. We were looking for a place to hold the first presentation. Okay, we put word out that we were giving an award to a kid, and we got inundated with applications, letters. And it was like, you know, we expected maybe, you know, 2, 3, 4, and all of a sudden we got 50 or 60, maybe more. And I'd gotten a phone call, and I don't remember the gentleman's name. There was a small convention. It was supposed to help to become a big convention in Las Vegas, Nevada, called Ham West. And I don't remember the people who put it together. I know the gentleman passed away. I think his wife's still around. And they asked me to come and be a speaker, and I said, sure. They said, you know, we'll pay your way, you know, we'll fly you up and give you a hotel. I'm not going to turn that down. My wife loves going to Vegas. Okay, fine. So I accepted the offer, and I mentioned, I said, you know, we're looking for a place to give this award. He says, well, when do you want to do it? I said, I don't know. We don't have set a date. We don't have a cutoff date for this thing. We just came up with the idea like a week ago. You know. He said, well, why don't you have it at Ham West? Okay. Again, my philosophy, never turn them down. Somebody says, off each other, take it, right? So the first, the very first Ham, a Young Ham of the Year Award was presented in Sin City in Las Vegas at the Ham West Convention. Actually, we did 2 years, I think, there at Ham West. Where did we go from there? We went from Ham West. We did a year at the in Atlanta at the Atlanta Ham Fest. Late Sandy Donahue, who just passed away. W4RU. He was our convinced us to bring us. We went there 1 year. Then we went to Huntsville. Then we went to Kansas City for a couple of years, and the PhD Amateur Radio Club hosted us for a couple of years. And this thing, again, it started, we didn't do anything. It's not like we went out and all of a sudden everybody's offering, you know, we want to support this. Everybody thought it was a good idea, so it became a major award unto itself. And now it wound up in 1992, I think it was 92, no, 93. We brought it to Huntsville. And then 94, we took it up to Seaside, Oregon. And since 95, it has been every year since then. Its home is the Huntsville Ham Fest, which will be where it will be this year again. We just opened up nominations this past weekend. And it will close on May 30th, and then we'll see who we get and what. Again, and then, of course, over the years, we've had other companies come in and offer assistance, and some with states, some have gone. But Yaesu has been there. Yaesu, which is Vertex there, has been there since day one. They're still with us. They're a great bunch of people. And about 10 years ago, got a call from the people at CQ, from Dick Ross, and he said, I'd like to be a part of this. And so we started to talk, and he came up with the idea of sending a kid to, since we're in Huntsville anyway, let's send the kid to space camp. And, of course, that's been, for the past decade, every kid who's been selected as Young Ham of the Year Award winner has been given the option of going to space camp. I think only one or two have turned it down because of other commitments, but that's been their story. So they basically, the award consists now of a trip to the Huntsville Ham Fest, expense paid. They get a radio. They get a plaque, which we pay for. Actually, Dave Bell, W6AQ, underwrites the plaque now. And CQ Magazine pays for them to go to, pays the cost for them to go to space camp. So that's what this little idea I got in the shower has gone to. And I think it's it means is, hey, kids in ham radio have a place. If they do something and that's really, Kevin Boudreau, N5XMH, back in, he was our 1993 winner, I think it was. Kevin, in the middle of a hurricane, he was a kid. He was 15 years old, but he begged his parents, these people need help. We need communication help. He was in Slidell, Louisiana. And Kevin went out with his radio, with his parents' consent, and actually spent the whole week working on relief. A kid. I mean, is that a hero to you? To me?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Kevin's now a graphics art designer and also a hotel manager down in on the East Coast. I forgot what to tell you. I talked to him on Facebook. Believe it or not, a lot of us old people are on Facebook, too.
Yes, that's and you and I correspond back and forth.
I got on Facebook only because I'll talk about this a little later, but my entire news department was on Facebook, so we used it to keep in touch. But no, Facebook is very handy. I keep in touch with my daughter and son-in-law, and my 15-year-old grandson is the only one of the four kids who's on there. But a lot of my friends who were involved with live theater are on there. A lot of my friends who were in Europe, which I wouldn't be able to get in touch with at odd times, are there. So it's a very, very, very handy communications medium. I don't look at it as anything more than a communications medium. I'm not involved with those causes. I'm not involved with what is it, Farmville, is it? I forgot the name of it.
There's Farmville.
Mafia Wars and all those games. I pay no attention to those things. It's a great, truly, and for Newsline, it's become a very good, and I think you use it also, it's a great way to talk to the people who are your listeners, you know?
Well, you know, my son Matt put the Facebook page up, and in 8 days, we had 2,500 friends sign up.
It's the same thing with us.
I don't know where they came from, because I was told that there's not a lot of hams on Facebook. Well, I bear to differ with you. There's a bunch of hams up on Facebook.
Trust me, there's loads of hams there. It's just that you don't know it because they're not on there with their call. Well, I'm not on there with my call. I'm Bill Pasternak. You're not going to find WA6ITF.
Well, you know,
same thing with you.
The thing that I was going to ask you about, and that is this. Folks that are tuning in now, and there are those out there, that have not heard of Amateur Radio Newsline. I talk to folks all the time, and I say you should listen to Amateur Radio Newsline. If a ham is listening to us right now, and there's a lot of them that are, where can they locate Amateur Radio Newsline? They certainly don't want to miss an episode at all. There's so much in there.
It's so simple. www.arnewsline.org. We've been on there with that for, I lost track of how many years. And It's a very fast-loading page. It's built on... Oh, I've got to ask Ron again, my web guy. But you click on our page, and it's there. There's no load time because we have no graphics that come up. There's nothing to load. It's just text-based. And pretty text, but it's text-based. And you scroll down the page, and about halfway down, you'll see it says... I think it's in blue. I'll have to go look. Let me take a quick look. I don't remember now. I should know. It's my own web page. Hold on. Okay, I'm on my web page. Yeah, if you go to arnewsline.org and you go down halfway down the page, you'll say download news script or download MP3 file, and that's the newscast. And then Kevin Trotman, N5PRE, has it out on iTunes and iPodder and iPodX and stuff as a podcast. So those are, you can go to any of those places and get it also. But if you want to get it right from the source, arnewsline.org, and just scroll down until you see it says download news script, and you can, if you want to read the news script, just click on it. If you want to save it, right click, and of course with the audio file, please download it. Do not try and stream it because we set up not to stream. It's just right click, and if you have a PC, it's right click, and then save target. I don't know much about Macs. I'm sure there's a way to do it. I'm sure there's a way it's done on Linux, and those people know how to do it. But for us PC people, it's right click and save the file. So,
And I was going to say, iTunes is so handy because there's like, I don't know, 250 million iPods out there or something like
yeah,
that.
I own one.
Yeah. And, when you go up to iTunes, if you select subscribe, when you plug that thing in, it vacuums it right out, and it goes right straight into the iPod and you don't have to miss a thing. And it's really, really cool because you can, today everybody's plugging the iPods into the stereo system in their car. They're going down the road and they got the earbuds on.
I have my entire, collection of show music, my entire collection of 50s and 60s rock. What else? A couple of what my friends call long hair music, classical stuff. And I don't think I've got one of these 4 gig nanos, and I haven't filled it half up yet.
Good
and
as well.
And I used to carry all these CDs, Now I just run the iPod and it plays through the Malibu's radio system. It's nice.
Well, I've got a 30 gig Zune, okay, and I see now that they're up to 120 gigs and so on and so forth, but the 30 gig Zune so far has been big enough to put things on, and I'm just amazed by the technology. And I'll tell you would not believe the number of people I get emails from. Well, yes, you would, because you're producing a show.
That's right.
That are saying, we discovered you on iTunes. We download the podcast. Of course, we're on shortwave. That's our staple, and we get more mail from the shortwave than we do off of iTunes. But it's
the same with us. We get most of our people, our repeater listeners. We're on umpteen repeat. At one time I knew for sure we were on 3,200 some odd repeaters around the world. I don't know what it is. It's been 15 years since I did my last survey, and one of these days we should do one, but we don't have anybody to do it. Unfortunately, Carl Pagel, M6BBU, who used to run our surveys for us, passed away about 6 months ago. So we're going through a changing of the guard for ourselves. Our people are getting older, and so it's... we're always looking for volunteers. If anybody wants to do surveys for us, we're looking also for somebody in California who's a CPA who wants to take over Andy's position and be our treasurer. I haven't been able to find anybody. I'm trying to do it, and I don't know anything about it. So luckily the people at Chase Bank have been very helpful to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, you know what? We're out of time, and I wish we could go... I wish we could go longer, but what we'll have to do, Bill, you're just going to have to come back, and we're going to have to talk some more because there's a lot more things I wanted to ask you about, and there's some things I'm sure you may have wanted to share with us, but we're out of time. But I want to extend this opportunity for you to share anything with us now just before we close that's still on your mind that maybe you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to.
I have so much on my mind, there's no time for it. But the one thing that I'd like to discuss is, to me, that's very important, is to remember, to everybody out there listening, remember, the future of amateur radio, the future of telecommunications, is not with us who are in their 60s and 50s and 60s. It's with these kids. It's the ones who are just getting their ham licenses. It's with the ones who never will get the ham license but have this interest, this unabiding interest in telecommunications. Nurture it. They're our future. They're the safety of the country. They're the future of our country, and they're the future of the world. Kids are where it's at, and it doesn't matter if it's in the arts or if it's in telecommunications or what. Nurture that, because that's the future. And that's my message, if there is any.
And if folks want to get involved with the program right now with the Young Ham of the Year Award, where is a good place to look for information, or where can they contact you to get a hold of
you? I made it real easy this year. Just go to our website, which I've mentioned umpteen times, I guess, so far. www.arnewsline.org. And just above where, just before it says where you can download the scripts and stuff, just above that it says 2010 Young Ham of the Year Award nominations now being accepted. Download 2010 filing instructions in Microsoft Word here. Click on here. Or you can nominate, get the nomination form by clicking on the next here and get it into us before May 30th of 2010. And it's all on the website. I think we become sometimes a little too dependent on websites, but that's where it is.
And for those, and this goes too for those that may want to get involved in giving you an item or something as part of the award to add to your collection of things that you give to the Young Ham of the Year. If they want to do that, that would definitely...
Call me. I won't say no. No, the best way to get in touch with me is email. Email is fine, and it's newsline@arnewsline.org. We try and keep everything simple. Or if somebody wants to call me, I'll give you the phone number 24/7. I may not pick it up, but I'll get back to you. It's area code 661. That's in Santa Clarita, California. 296-7180, and that's the Newsline's main number. And if I don't answer you, it's either I'm not home or I'm sleeping. Right now it's 12:15 our time here, so it's because we're doing this. Let's be honest, we're recording this thing at odd hours. I'll be up for another hour and a half, 2 hours. I'm a night owl, as I said, and I'll probably be doing some writing. So if somebody needs to get me, if I'm up, I'll answer the phone. Because it only rings in here, and it doesn't bother the rest of the family, thank heaven. So.
And if you folks forget the phone number or the address, just look on our QSO site, and we will have a link to Amateur Radio Newsline that will take you into their site. And also we'll have another link up there, too, for contacting Bill over the Young Ham of the Year Award. So just go to our site.
Just a link to our website, and it's all there right in front in one spot.
And, of course, there's always Google, you know.
Yeah, when in doubt, we are there.
When in doubt, you just Google, you know.
Okay, you're just making me do this. You're forcing me to do this. I'm going to try this. I haven't never done this before. Amateur. Yeah. Radio. Newsline. Okay, you ready?
Okay.
I spelled it wrong. Hang on, let me fix it.
Uh-oh.
It's not Moosline, it's Newsline.
Well, okay. You know, I bet you would still find it.
Believe it or not, this surprised me. We're the first one up on top.
I bet you if you go back and you misspell Newsline, make it Moosline like you had, I bet it'll still
all
find
right.
It.
All right, let's try it. Moosline? Okay, yeah. Let's see what happens. It comes up. Do you mean amateur radio Newsline? You're right. It's smarter than we are, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful.
By the way, if we're on Wikipedia, I didn't do it, but somebody put us up on Wikipedia, I guess, because I know I've seen this before. So we do exist on Wikipedia. And who is this? Amateur radio is this? This is an example of an amateur radio station. I have no idea who put this up. It's the first time I've ever seen it.
That's incredible. Well, sir, I thank you so much. WA6ITF Bill Pasternak has been our guest. We're going to have him back because he has a lot of stories to tell
very compelling stories to tell.
War stories, you know.
And, of course, all of us hams, we like to gather around the campfire, and that's what we do here at QSO. So
I'll bring my guitar in next time.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of QSO. Be sure and tune in again Thursday for another QSO. Once again, thanks to our guest, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, for joining us today. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO.